side of your handout today has in it, and we'll get to that in a few minutes in detail. Okay, so we're going to look at the title pages of the four Gospels. And if you think about what's on the title page of Matthew, now Matthew starts out with a genealogy. And that's going to be significant in today's story. And so keep that in mind. I'll remind you that the pictures that we have, both the color pictures of the four writers, and they're thought to be painted on those boards by the scribe who did the transcriptions. Most of these Gospels all came from one single individual who was trying to get some uniformity in the presentation of these stories. And so there are some exceptions. There's some parts of some of these manuscripts that were not done by the same scribe, but most of them were done by one scribe. And so the images that we have of this come from the Center for the Study of New Testament Manuscripts, and that's not in Washington, D.C. That's in Plano, Texas. We talked about that last week. But they insist that whenever you publish any of these or show them publicly, that you give them the credit for the images. Now, they have taken the pictures that have been made of all of these manuscripts and put them on the Internet. So you can download from CSNTM. If you Google that, it'll take you right to their website. And you get a list of hundreds of fragments and whole manuscripts such as these that you can look at at your leisure. It's all in Greek, however, so get out your Greek dictionary and then you can proceed from there. What you really need to work with these is a Greek interlinear English text of some sort. Those are available in bookstores. Okay, now the premise of this lesson and of all of these lessons is that we understand that the Bible is inspired by God and was transmitted by His power to our day and age, essentially intact. And so we're not worried about this, but we talk to people all the time who are skeptics about these matters. And this is a very important thing about the skepticism, that what they believe, you can, in effect, shoot down their concept, give them something to think about anyway. 2 Peter 1:16, he says, "We did not follow cleverly invented stories." Now, that's what the skeptic's going to claim. "When we told you about the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but we were eyewitnesses of His majesty." And Jesus Himself said in John 14, talking to His apostles, "All this I've spoken while still with you, but the Counselor, the Holy Spirit, whom the Father will send in my name, He will teach you all things and will remind you of everything I've said to you." And you might wonder, well, an eyewitness. These men were all eyewitnesses of Jesus, but how could they remember everything that He said? Well, the Holy Spirit gave them the special power of memory here so that they could write all this down accurately. All right. So here's what the skeptic's theory is. Now, the skeptic is an unbeliever. And you meet these people all the time. They may not enunciate these ideas, but that's what they're depending on, is that the Bible's not true. And so they say, okay, we'll concede that Jesus probably was a living person, a real person. But surely He did not have supernatural powers. They don't think anybody has supernatural powers. Even the magicians who seem to be able to, by sleight of hand, to do all sorts of strange things. The story of Jesus was transmitted orally for several centuries. That's what they believe. That none of this was written down in the first century, the second century. Maybe in the third century some of it was written down, and it was all gathered together once the Christian religion became the legal religion in Rome. And so it took several hundred years, by their view, to get all of this in writing. It was finally written down by Christians with good to be true, in other words, in their view. It had to be sort of synthesized somewhere. And his conclusion is the Gospels cannot be trusted as eyewitness accounts, even though in the Bible it says that they are. Okay, so that's the person you're talking to who is doubtful about the validity of the Gospels. And the Gospels are the heart of the New Testament. Keep that in mind. Paul and the others, when they're writing the rest of the New Testament, they're always referring back to things that Jesus did, and that's important that the Gospels be true. All right. And we looked at these pages, like this one is the one on the left, and it's a facsimile. It isn't the real thing. Okay. These are made on vellum. We talked about that last week. And we'll come back to them. This is Matthew's first page. And I point out that all of these spots occur essentially on the first page and the last page of each of these Gospels. Kind of strange why they have those black spots on them. And it's thought, Lee Woodard thought this up, I guess, and some others agree with him, that these Gospels were gathered. They were protected somewhere and kept away from the authorities during persecutions, but brought out at night and viewed by lamplight. And occasionally the lamp would drip upon the page and it'd wipe it off, but it would have some debris in it of some sort that would darken with time and make black spots ultimately on the first and last pages as they showed these Gospels to visiting dignitaries, the scribes who were in charge of keeping them. All right? So we'll come back to Matthew's first pages later on, but this is on the left two pages we have the genealogy of Jesus. And I'll remind you of what we talked about last week. So all of the earlier manuscripts just have capital letters. And they're all written together, as we saw. The words aren't separated out or anything. You have to parse the words as you go through. But many of these letters are the same as they are in the English alphabet. And so we have the few that are in red are the ones that will trip you up when you're trying to do something. And we're actually going to read a little bit of names this morning because they're familiar to you. And names don't change when the language changes. But the P in these documents is really an R. And the C is an S. Okay? The one that throws me the most is Epsilon. That's the U. But it's written as a Y. They don't have a Y. But that's a capital U. And so when you see that, what looks to us a Y, think U. And Chi, an X, is really the first part of the word Christ. And the Omega, the W, is not really a W, it's an O. So you have to think about those five letters particularly, and then some of the letters which are unique to the Greek alphabet, of course, they don't have an F, they have a PH, and that sort of thing, and a PS. And a Zion and so on. But those are lesser used and they're not so frequently encountered. But you do have things like gamma and lambda, which are unique Greek letters, and we have to deal with those when we come to them. All right, now one other thing that they did in writing out these manuscripts was use abbreviations quite a bit. Words that occur very, very frequently in the Gospels, like the name Jesus Christ, are abbreviated, and an abbreviation always has a line above it. So Jesus, which is Yesus, I-A-S-O-U-S, is abbreviated I-S. And our of the Codex. We're going to talk about the fact that it's a book. When the scribes figured out how to make a book instead of a scroll, it was a big advance because you could write on both sides of the page and you could flip the pages in the book and find things without having to unroll a long scroll. So that was a big technical advance, and we have to look at the details of what they discovered about how to do this. But you can see the tattered edges on the right. And at the bottom, I have the translation of the first part of this. This is the book of the generations of Jesus Christ, son of David, and son of Abraham. And we'll be able to find those names in there in a few minutes. Now, there's John's and Luke's first pages, and they, too, have the oil spots on them from being opened up to those pages and poured over by the people who were visiting the writers here at this point in time. And we're talking about something that happened in the first century because the notations that were made on the pages are in Aramaic. That's unheard of in connection with the rest of the manuscripts of the New Testament. So these were people who came down from Israel or somewhere and were looking to see as these very holy scriptures were being written out and examined. And they would drag them out at night, apparently, and show them to their visitors. So here's John's and Luke's first pages, the tops of them. You can see where the titles are written. And you have here a distinction between the first pages. This is typical. This is after Luke, L-O-U-K-A-N. This is a lambda. And so we have the writing of the first few lines of Luke. Up here we have John. And you see that the decoration of the title up here was just a few lines above and below it. But up here there's extra decorations on the title for John, Iwanen. And the writing is somewhat different. The K, for example, that the scribe writes here, has the foot on the right side of the K attached to the upper line. It generally is that way, where the scribe down here is going to bring this foot back to the junction of the K. All of the three parts of a K come to one point. And so there's a reason why this is one of those exceptions where a different scribe had written this, and we'll see in January, we'll look at that when we get back into the study as to why that was the case. It turns out to be pretty critical that that was the case. And here we have Mark's first page. It also has the oil spots on it. And the last pages have the same sort of thing. Okay. Yeah. Oh, we got one of these back. Everybody seen this one? Did you go all the way around? All right. The pages, the idea of putting a book together from separate pages came about, but there wasn't any way to construct it. Because if you try to sew on the edge, doesn't do any good back there, on the edge of the page here, it tears out. The best we can do in modern times with something like a ring binder, you know, the problem is that the holes tear out. And so the advance from that is to make a spiral binder, which has many holes along the edge, but those even can tear out with use in long time. And so the way to make a book that was stable was somewhat of a tricky process. And we'll look at that in just a second. Here's Mark's first page, and it's just like Matthew and Luke and its writing. And you see his title, the three words across the top, and he separated out K-A-T-A, which means according to, and Mark is on the right-hand side, and the word on the left is the gospel according to Mark. The gospel according to Mark. Okay. Now, here's an example of the use place of the taking the word and abbreviating it here. This is an I epsilon and a chi epsilon, and so that Jesus Christ, and the word here is the Son, and over here we have a theta epsilon, which is upsilon, I mean, which is God. And so Jesus Christ, the Son of God. So anyway, let's look at a manuscript that was written a couple hundred years later. And now, you see, on the left, on the right, you have a magnification of what's on the left over here. But you can easily see the scribes really had made it in great advance in their ability to write these letters and took great care in it. And this particular book, which is in the Vatican, is in great shape. It's well bound. It's solid. And right through here, you can see something scribbled on the front page, and it includes a date of September 1873. And so that's probably when they put it in the library. Notice this scribe, instead of running out of room over here and immediately going back to the left, he makes little bitty letters to try to finish out A-B-R-A-A-M. Who do you suppose that is? That's Abram, isn't it? Abraham. And so here he has a little letter and a hyphen, kind of tying it to the word over here, which is I-F-K. And so he's spaced it out, and he's not trying to cram everything into a small number of pages. He's leaving space, isn't he? And that's kind of nice, because what he's doing here with this genealogy, you can see, is separating out the very steps of it all the way down to the time, to the point where he brings in, everywhere from Abraham all the way down to Jesus. So he does some indentation and some organization of it, and that's the way many of the manuscripts, the later manuscripts, looked, which was a big improvement. But this manuscript, which came later, includes all of the names that are in Matthew's in Codex W. And I contend that this was copied probably maybe primarily or secondarily from the Codex W. We'll look at that. Now, the making of a book. The key advance to making books was the realization that you didn't have to bind single pages at the edge. You could take a page like this, fold it in two, and create a ditch here, which was very stable, and put holes in that and thread through there, and you aren't near the edge of the paper at all. And books even today are made that way. And so when they realized they could do that, they took a series of these pages and put them together. So we have here a cluster, or what they called a gathering, of four pages like that, which then they would sew down in the seam. And these are stacked, as you see in the photograph, as they make I think this is a dictionary of some sort, a whole bunch of these together. This is called a quire, Q-U-I-R-E, or a gathering. And originally they all had four pages like this, which makes eight leaves, separate pages, upon which the scribes could write. They could write front and back, and that makes 16 pages of text. You see how that's done? And then you pick another quire and do it the same way as you're proceeding your way through the manuscript you're copying, and stack those in a certain order. And then you can bind, you can see the threads that are holding all of these together. They use a very strong cord of some sort to hold these together in two places at least along the book, And then eventually that's attached to the leaf, to the covers of the book. And you can make it very stable. And if you pour some glue in there, you can make it even more stable, of course. Now, when Henry Sanders was the authority that took Codex W, when it was first discovered, took it from Mr. Freer and did the studies. He was a professor of ancient writing at University of Michigan. Yeah, I think that's right. And he took the book, and it was bound with cords and these wooden covers, and he took it apart. He took the binding off, and he opened up all of the quires, these little gatherings of parts of the manuscript. He made notations upon where they started and where they ended, each quire. It went through 16 pages, you see. And so he could keep track of all of that. And then he cut the quires apart. And that's why, when you look at one of these pages, one edge is ragged. That was the outer edge of the book. But this was back at where the quires came together. And so it's a straight edge. And you can tell whether you're looking at the front here, when the quire is on your left, and when you're looking at the back of the page, when the straight edge is on the right, then you have an idea of where you are in the text. So he looked at all of that. He took all the pages apart because he wanted to photograph them, and so he could lay them flat and take pictures of all of them, front and back. And as I pointed out, there were 183 leaves, which is 376 or some odd number like that of pages in the text, of which only three leaves were missing. There were two leaves in John and one leaf in Mark, I think, that had disappeared. He had probably pulled those out of the book. Maybe they were loose for some reason, and used them as advertising. The man who dug them up out of the sand used them to circulate among his potential buyers for the treasure. And so those disappeared, but all of the rest of it is there. Okay. And on the right, you can see, I guess we should take a quick look at that material. A quire is an assembly of four sheets. It's kind of a summary, folded together to make eight leaves, and 16 pages front and back. Threads are passed through the fold and tied to hold the quires together, as you see over here. In Codex W, the folded edges were glued to a leather binding band and sewn to the wooden covers through holes drilled near their edges. And now, I failed you in making this facsimile because it doesn't have the holes across this edge. But they were there. They are there in the original. And all of the binding materials were kept with the manuscript in the Smithsonian Institution in the Freer Art Gallery. Okay. Everybody's there with us now. That story is important to understand what we've got in Matthew's genealogy. So here are the first three pages of text. The first leaf front and back, and the second leaf front. And you can see that the wear edge, of course, this is the same page viewed from the other side. The wearing edge over here is different from the one on the second page because this page was goatskin vellum, and this page was sheepskin vellum. And this page was actually the first page of a quire of eight pages, and this page had to be glued along this edge to this page. Now, after 2,000 years, the glue had failed and didn't hold anything together very well, but originally, obviously, it did, and that stabilized it because we had a single page added to the front of Matthew's genealogy, and that to his whole text. And the genealogy was means, and if you go down your book, your English version, you'll see that it reads, as we started out before, this is the book of the genealogies of Jesus Christ, and here we have Abram. Now, Abram's name occurs twice because son of Abram was the last part of that sentence, and Abraham gave birth or begat Isaac. Isaac begat, there's a long word here which means begat. For the life of me, can't understand why the scribe went through writing that 41 times in this whole program and didn't abbreviate it. I mean, if I were he, I would have abbreviated that right away. But he writes it out every time. And as it turns out, we have about one name per line going down here, and I've given you the names. Many of those you will recognize as the kings. Some of these are the patriarchs. And we get to Obed, Jesse, and David, Boaz, Solomon. So those are names that you recognize from your readings. And here are the names of the kings. And that carries you through part of this. And on the back side of the page, we have some more names, Jeconiah. And we have a name that talks about the captivity in Babylon. And here's the word Babylon. And then here's Salathiel, Zerubbabel, you might remember him from Ezra and Nehemiah. And it goes through a list of names, which finally gets us down to Joseph, who was the husband of Mary. And then it says, who gave birth to Jesus, who was also called the Christ. And so we can translate that. Because we understand enough of the language here to see those names. Now, here's the peculiar thing about this genealogy. Not only is it written on a different kind of vellum, but apparently Matthew brought it to the scribe and he said, here's the genealogy of Jesus. But the genealogy he brought had someone else's name here. I don't know, we don't know who it was, but this has been scraped by the scribe. You know that a scribe had several tools to his trade that he worked with. One, of course, was a pen. He made pens out of feathers. But to make a pen, he had to have something called a pen knife. And so he took his pen knife and sharpened his quill and made it so that it would carry the ink to the page. But when he made a mistake, he could also scrape the ink off of the vellum, which apparently was done here. You can see the parallel lines at the top here, where he removed someone's name and wrote in Jesus Christ. The I, apparently, here was retained from the earlier name. I think it was a name like Jacob or Joseph, and it was erased and replaced with Jesus Christ. Now, the rest of the names in such a document would be the same for any Jew all the way down to the back side of the page, because the genealogy, any of you that have done genealogies, you know you can make a genealogy until you get to the last few generations. It's the same for everybody in your family. And so here we have the backside where that kind of a change was made, where this red arrow is. Here we have Joseph's name, I Omega S E F, and so who was married to Mary, and so on. Now we'll translate that. So and so, actually Jacob up here begat Joseph, the husband of Mary, to whom was born Jesus, who is called Christ. Now, if you look at that with the separation in it of the translation, up here, if you adjust the exposure just right, you can see that this writing is darker than the writing down below. And the reason, apparently, was all of this was just simply added on to the end of the genealogy that he brought to the scribe. And the scribe started with the story translating what Matthew had written onto this page and then moving on. kind of a document would be like a birth certificate. Remember that Joseph and Mary went to Bethlehem early on before Jesus was born? And why did they go? Well, he had to register in Bethlehem because that's where his ancestors had. He was a son of David, a descendant of David. And so he had to have documentation, and he probably carried a document just like this to prove who he was and that he was indeed the son of David. And so this would be something that would be available to people to prove who they were. And you might remember when they rebuilt Jerusalem after the Babylonian captivity, there were a lot of people who were undocumented, and they had trouble proving who they were, particularly among the priests. And so a document like this was very valuable. And I think Ken had a point he wanted to make. Is the name that they used for this particular place. And it was, they had to carry these documents down there, and then the scribe was working on them there. Well, I don't know how the skeptic would use this. You see, what fooled Henry Sanders, the person who was analyzing this material, the expert, he said, okay, this Matthew is cobbled together from some other sources. You see, his answer was it isn't an early document, it must be a more recent document where they took parts of several other manuscripts and assembled them. But he didn't think about the fact that Matthew might be taking documents from several sources and assembling them into his final document. And that, clearly this is not something that had to be inspired of God. This was a matter of record. The list of the names of the people who preceded him. And it proved Matthew, and maybe had an afterthought about this after he had written the rest of his manuscript, said, nobody has, in these Gospels, nobody has a genealogy of Jesus, and it's important to show that he was the son of David, that he was the one who would be inheriting the throne of David. And so he brought along a genealogy and said, let's put this genealogy there. It's the same for everybody until you get down to the last two or three lines in that genealogy. And here we have Jacob and Joseph and Jesus put in there. Now, I don't know why that would be looked upon as being something less than authentic, but we're going to see in just a moment that Matthew himself approved of this document. Okay, a point here, Gary. That's right. Well, let's look at that. Here is the seal of Matthew on the last page. The last page of Matthew contains something we're going to talk about, and the next class is not going to occur until we get to January because of the Christmas holidays, but and I'm going to be gone next week, so Ken's going to take the class next week. But here we have the ending of Matthew. And over here, here's how it ends, and again, he has oil spots on it. And here's the ending, and it says, the Gospel according to Matthew, they put that at the end as well. And right here is a round seal. It's about a half an inch in diameter. And it has some writing underneath it. Now, Woodard thought it important to try to determine what that writing was. And I must admit to you that it isn't really clear exactly what's there. But looking at this not in ordinary light, but looking at it in UV light, he could pick up some more traces of that. And it appears that it contains two kinds of things. Contains what looks to be Matthew smeared out a little bit. An A-U-N, which is on, in the Old Testament was spelled O-N in most translations. On, which was a suburb of Heliopolis, which is now Cairo, incidentally, in Egypt. And then it has some Aramaic markings down below it. And you could see that even in the original. So this seems to be the seal of authority that Matthew put to the document when the scribe was through with it, that he stamped it with his seal. And we'll talk about the seals. All four Gospels have a seal like this one at the end of each of those four Gospels as it ended. And in the case of Mark had an ending and a seal, and he changed his mind and decided to add several more lines, a couple of paragraphs, and so he scraped the first seal off, but you can still see where it was, put a new seal in its place. So we're going to talk about the seals next week, or next time. It'll be in January. Okay. Here are the conclusions and the reasoning behind this. A standard genealogy was brought to the scriptorium and used as a starting point for Matthew's gospel. That's the fact that it had someone else's name at the start didn't matter as far as they were concerned. That's just who the document belonged to and or who it was aiming at. The critical point came at the end of it where they gave Jesus' name and gave the details about Joseph and Mary and Jesus and then went into the birth. Well, they had a paragraph about the fact that there were 14 generations from Abraham to David and 14 generations from David to the Babylonian captivity and 14 more to the Christ. Actually, there's only 13 more, but then there's the argument about who miscounted there or did they leave out a name, and that doesn't matter. But anyway, that was a standard genealogy, probably would apply to a lot of people. But they applied it specifically to Jesus. And Matthew started then with the rest of his gospel at the bottom of that document and went right on into the main part and wound up with a choir instead of eight. It had nine leaves to it, and that's the unique part about the thing. It was on goatskin vellum and was attached to the first choir of sheepskin vellum. The name Jesus Christ was inserted in the place of an earlier name in verse 1. And that earlier name may have been a relative. It may have been somebody that these people knew who had this document. And these documents were valuable. The priests had the original records of everybody's genealogy, and if you went and had one made for you, you had to have a scribe. Probably had to, sort of like paying for someone who's officially can make a document for you. What's that? I'm sorry? Notary public is the word I'm looking for. That's right. Yeah, some notary would make one for him. This modification was approved by Matthew, and his seal at the end of the account certified the document. Now, the fact that all existing manuscripts contain the Matthew genealogy is in agreement with the idea that this was a source document. But it says there was a time when Matthew had a document that didn't have the genealogy at the start. Okay? And so, okay. They kept their genealogies, and that, the name that was scraped out, I don't think was Joseph, because the last letter was an F, which would have extended above and below a phi, but it could have been Jacob. That would be my case, my guess. And the ink in the editions was slightly different from the ink earlier. It was a browner ink, and it faded faster. And so you can see that the bulk of the document below that edition, on the backside I'm talking about, was with the same scribe, apparently, did both of them, though. And so whoever did that document for Jesus or for Joseph was someone that they knew. And we're going to talk about the scribe toward the end of the class. Scribe was probably Barnabas. And it could be Barnabas, the son of Mark, but it's thought to be probably Barnabas who accompanied Paul on his missionary journeys. Okay, well, our time is gone. So that's just the first bit. Think of it in this way. We're looking at circumstantial evidence. 2,000 years later, we can't be real sure about anything. But we're going to talk about circumstantial evidence, and you're the jury. And if you have one or two bits of circumstantial evidence, that's questionable. That may not mean much. But if you got a dozen bits of circumstantial evidence that all point to the same conclusion, that tends to be much more significant. And that's where we're going with this. We'll see some other things that point to an early date for these documents, and we'll look at that in January. Hope you'll come back then. Thank you for your interest.